the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, since the November elections, the markets have been setting record highs as a record streak. The markets were up double digits last year. That was a surprise, surprise. Nobody seemed to expect that. 2017, here we are, and the Dow and the S&P are now setting new all-time records. So after years of sitting on the sideline in the midst of a bull market, suddenly the euphoria is back. Investors are jumping back in. It is amazing how this works on psychology alone. Just a few months of increases are changing everybody's investment strategy.
Well, nothing like rising prices to catch everybody's attention, though. But as we have talked about on our weekend show, a lot of this move is money that is speculating, John, that things are going to get better. There's hope that the government's going to spend more money on fiscal policy, whether it's infrastructure or rebuilding the military, tax cuts, whether they're individual tax cuts or corporate tax cuts. You know, all of that would be helpful. But here's the thing. A lot of this is being done on anticipation. And as we have seen, and of course, as the Trump administration is experiencing, trying to get things done through Congress is another thing. I don't care if it's the appointment of cabinet members, if it's a Supreme Court justice, or God forbid, trying to get legislation actually passed. I mean, it's like one giant sausage factory. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal, which we talked about with one of my guests on the weekend program, and it was talking about environmental regulations and all the things that have to be done. The article talked about a bridge that was falling apart, but because of all the regulations, the environmental impact studies, it took almost 15 years to actually get the repairs made. So even though, let's say, Congress or the Trump administration were to pass, let's say, a $1 trillion spending program, it could be 10 to 15 years before things actually get done. And that's how bad it is. You know, if you've been watching the news, you've probably seen up in Northern California where we have a dam which was in danger of bursting. They know there's something wrong with it, but actually trying to get permitting to go in there and fix the thing. And of course, we're against dams. A lot of the environmental policies like to do away with them. So the markets are moving on speculation that things are going to get better. The reality is these things may take a long time. Outside of, let's say, immediate tax cuts, trying to get government spending programs implemented, which is something that I think President Obama found out in his administration 8 years that all the shovel-ready projects they thought were going to be available weren't really available. So a lot of this is speculating right now, and I think there's a real risk here if people start changing their investment philosophy just because the stock market is hitting new records. As we pointed out on the weekend program, this is the third priciest stock market in the last 100 years.
So I guess what we're saying here is that the market seems to be moving on the fact that these things are going to get passed and actually done. We saw that bump again this week when the talk of tax reform came in. Now, that's a knockdown, slug 'em out battle. You know that one is going to be, and what the final result looks like remains to be seen. But the reality is, as a result of this, I mean, this is a slugfest going on in Washington right now. This may take a long time. Even though the euphoria is leading on it, the results may be a while in coming.
They may be a while in coming. And the problem is investors are chasing returns, and we're seeing a large change in the perceptions of risk by individual investors as they change their portfolios from what was in place prior to the election. It was a risk-off portfolio since the election, and especially this year, it's a risk-on portfolio. So the problem is people are chasing returns. I mean, you wake up each morning, you watch the news, what are you seeing? The Dow is at an all-time record, as it is on the day we're doing this broadcast. The S&P is at an all-time record. So a lot of these numbers, people are saying that, you know, it's kind of like, I don't want to miss out on this action. So all of a sudden, investors are changing their risk preferences, which is probably one of the riskiest things you can do if you're 10 years away from retirement, or you just retired or close to retirement, or are currently retired. You just don't go chasing things and changing your risk tolerance just because the market's setting all-time records.
Yeah, and there's some hazards in all of this, too, because the current rage seems to be passive investing, where people are going into index funds trying to maximize the elevator ride up. But are they reckoning with what happens if we take a 10 or, 15% correction that's going to bring that back down again?
It's passive investing. Most people don't realize that most of the major indexes, whether you're looking at the Dow Jones Industrial Average or you're looking at the S&P 500, those are active indexes. Almost 15 to 20% of the stocks that make up the S&P are changed every single year. In other words, companies are taken out, they move new companies in. Same thing with the Dow. I mean, you take a look at, I think General Electric is one of the few companies of the original Dow 30 stocks that's left. And I mean, if you back out some of the new stocks that have been added, whether it's Goldman Sachs or you're talking about Apple, the Dow Jones Industrial Average would be at a much different level. So even index investing is not passive. It is active, because these indexes, the S&P changes every year and the Dow is changed every couple of years. The problem is, John, most investors aren't passive. What they tend to do is they buy when the market is close to a top, just as we're seeing right now. And one of the things that we follow in our firm is we follow fund flows. In other words, every single week, where is money moving in the markets? Is it moving into stocks? Is it moving into bonds? If it's moving into stocks, where is it moving? Is it moving into various sectors? And last year, the bulk of the money was going in the bond market. And that was a good story until you got to the election, when we hit a low in interest rates in the middle of the summer last year, when treasuries got down to 1.3. And then we rose almost 0.5% leading up to the elections at 1.8. And by the end of the year, we were almost close to, I think it was 2.6%. So bond investors essentially gave back all their gains of the year. So what happens? This year, they're exiting their bond funds because the Fed's raising interest rates and bonds lost money the last 3 months of the year. Now they're going into stock funds, chasing stocks, because stocks are going up. And what we've found historically is it's almost like a contrary indicator. They buy at tops and they sell at close to bottoms. And this was an example. The best thing I can tell you is the biggest selling in exodus out of stock funds occurred in 2009, just as the bear market was ending in March of that year. For the entire year, money was fleeing stocks, in fact, well into 2010. Another example, in 2011, the price of silver went from September 2010 all the way up to $50 an ounce in April of 2011, and gold went from $1,400 to $1,900. Investors rushed in the gold market in 2011, was silver peaking in April and gold peaking in September, and experienced heavy losses the next 3 or 4 years. And this was a question that I brought up with billionaire investor Ken Fisher when I had him on the program a couple of weeks ago when we talked about passive investing.
Well, almost no one, not no one, but almost no one actually invests truly passively. They just use passive tools to invest actively. And by that, I mean, whether it's buying just the S&P 500 through something like the SPDR or some combination of ETFs, they buy things that they think will do well for them. And then in some period ahead, not terribly long in time, could be a year, could be 3 years, when those things end up not doing well, they dump them at the bottom and they either move to something that's another form of passive vehicle that's been hot, or they just give up on the passive thing and move on to whatever the next stupid thing is that they want to do. The real trend, and I mentioned this in a different way earlier, in the last few years has been to move to U.S. only passive, because U.S. has been doing better than foreign. That works as long as it works. At the point in time where foreign starts to do better than U.S., lots of these people after a year or two will become disenchanted with what they had done, may not or may move to foreign, but either way, they're going to get whipsawed. They get whipsawed by moving to foreign too late. They get whipsawed by getting out of U.S. only at the bottom. But most people, you know, there's this very long history that's been documented forever in a parallel mode where investors in no-load funds do worse by far than the no-load funds do because they in and out of them at all the wrong times. And you buy the growth fund when it's hot and you buy and you sell out when it's not. And then you buy a bond fund at the wrong time and you buy the value fund at the wrong time and the foreign fund and the emerging market fund. And it's that trading the vehicles backwards that hurts so much, but it's so easy to do that with passive because it's cheap, it's easy to trade. You buy this thing that's been doing well, and nobody thinks through the fact when they're buying S&P 500 only passive, which has been the trend in the last few years, that they're riding a trend. And when the wave goes down, they're going to go down with the wave, and the passiveness doesn't protect them from that at all. And then they change their mind, and when they change their mind and move out of it, they're no longer passive.
There was an interview that you did, Jim, with Ken Fisher. He's a billionaire investor, chairman of Fisher Investments. And what he's saying is that people are still following the latest fad and trends. And even if they're in passive funds, say, for example, they're still chasing the trends.
That's one of the biggest risks that investors have to deal with is their own human emotions. I mean, you know, let's say that you got out of bond funds towards the end of the year because you ended up giving back all your gains that you had in the first part of the year. You gave them all back in the second half of the year as interest rates, people were losing money in bonds. And so what was going up after Trump got elected is stocks. What was going down after Trump got elected was bonds. And so you see this, John, you see all of a sudden people switch at the beginning of the year. It's a new year and say, all right, that didn't work for me last year. The stock market's going up. This is what I'm going to be in this year. And when you turn on the TV and you see interest rates are going up, which means bonds are losing money, and you see the stock market is setting new records, it's kind of like, I'm on the wrong trend. And so people vacillate with their emotions between fear and greed. And last year, the best example is investors were cautious, and it was the risk on trade, which was the trade to be in the first part of the year. It was not the trade to be in the second half of the year, because after Trump's election, everybody, including the experts, were taken by surprise. And so now investors are bullish on stocks because stocks are going up. They're bearish on bonds, employing money out of their bond funds. And unfortunately, John, investment decisions are driven by emotion rather than reason. And it is a real dangerous thought process to be chasing returns of your age 50 and above, because you can't afford to make your decisions on emotions or chasing the latest fad. And the best example I can give you is what happened to boomers during the last decade. I mean, from 2000 to 2002, we were supposed to be in the new economy. Instead, investors lost 45%. If you're in the S&P, if you're in technology stocks, you lost 70%. Then in 2007 and 2009, where were investors invested? In 2007, they were in stocks again or in real estate. What happened? We had another financial crisis and the stock market was down 45%. So in the last 8 years, the stock market has been going up every single year. We've been in a bull market since March of 2009. And what we do know, and we've covered this, I've written about it recently because I think it's important. That's why I'm writing again, is kind of like a warning to investors, is that every single recession and bear market has been Fed-induced since World War II. Every single recession was preceded by a Fed rate raising cycle, and every recession has produced a bear market in stocks. What do we know that we have going right now? This week, Janet Yellen was on Capitol Hill. What is she telling? We're going to be raising interest rates. So, you know, heads up, everyone. We've got a Fed that is hell-bent on raising interest rates, and we know the ultimate outcome when they do that. We will eventually have a recession and a bear market. So this is one of the things that you have to be cautious, and you can't be chasing and letting your human emotions dictate what you're doing, chasing the latest fad, the latest trends. And we see this all the time. All you have to do is go to a bookstore, if there's still a few left, go to the magazine section and take a look at the financial magazines. You know, they talk about the hottest stock fund, the best performing stock fund last year, the best performing ETF, the best sector of last year. And what we're always doing is we're always chasing last year's winners. We're always looking through the rearview mirror. And the important thing is you need to have an allocation plan that fits your risk, your goals, and what your personal needs are. And you don't change that just because the news changes every week, because I guarantee you the news is going to change every single week. And you have to stick to that plan.
Yeah, but does diversification really work? I mean, because it seems like during the 2007-2009 downturn, I mean, everything went down, and maybe that's why they're doing what they're doing.
Not exactly, because there are things that are uncorrelated. There's a number of studies, and we'll just take the year 2008. If you were in a money market fund in 2008, the rate of return was 2.8%. If you were in, let's say, intermediate bond funds like corporate bonds, you made 5%. If you were in intermediate treasuries, you made over 13% in 2008. Now, if you were in junk bonds, you lost 21%. If you were in stock funds, you lost over 40%. If you were in international stock funds, you were 45%. Well, here's the problem, John. If you have everything in stocks, let's say you have some large cap stocks, some small cap stocks, some international cap stock funds, well, guess what? You're all in stocks. So when the stock market went down like it did in 2008, you lost money. But if you had an allocation mix where you had money in cash, like money market funds, you had money in bonds, well, the bonds made you money, cash made you money, so your risk was reduced dramatically through holding assets that are uncorrelated. If you're all in stocks, well, if the stock market goes down, you're going to lose money. And the problem is people are going into these stock funds or stock ETFs and they're unaware of the risk. There are a lot of bond funds out there that lost a lot of money in the fourth quarter last year because a lot of the bonds that are in the funds are illiquid bonds. So when people were redeeming their assets, it was forcing those bond fund managers to sell these bonds that were illiquid at lower prices. And people are unaware of the risk that they're taking in ETFs or their mutual funds. And in the industry, we have three ways that we measure risk. It's called the Sharp, the Trainer, or the Jensen Index. All of these are just fancy terms. They measure the unit of risk that a person is taking in investments. In other words, you can take two investments that have, let's say, a 10% return in a single year, but one is a lot more riskier than the other based on these other ratios that we talked about, like the Sharp, Trainer, or the Jensen Index. And I don't want to get into the particulars of those, but any person that has a portfolio, whether it's ETFs or mutual funds, better know what those indexes mean, because they may be in ETFs or, let's say, mutual funds that are much higher risk given the rate of return that they produce. And this is something most people don't look at. And the reason you want to diversify, John, is it's one of the ways you reduce unsystematic risk in the markets by owning uncorrelated assets. And this was the big problem in 2008. It was the same problem in 2000, is people were all in the same asset category. In 2000, they were all in tech stocks. In 2007, they were all in stocks. And that's what we're seeing right now, because bonds were the loser in the last part of last year. People are flipping out of their bond funds, their bond ETFs. And as Ken Fisher is saying here, and they're going into stock funds. And, you know, a lot of people aren't even in international stock funds because of what happened to them in the 2007 to 2009 downturn. You lost actually more money if you were in international funds than you were in domestic funds.
Let's do an example of what you're talking about. And the reason is because if you look back in our living memory, you know, our parents used to talk about the Great Depression all the time, but the worst market downturn since then, and that's in our living memory, was 2007 and 2009. Now, what tends to happen as people move further and further away from shall we say, disasters, they tend to forget. And then their behavior changes.
I want to use this example because it illustrates, even in one of the worst markets that we've seen, as you referred to, is that if you have a proper allocation, you don't need to fear about what's going to happen in a downturn. And the example I'm going to give you, let's just take and make this real easy. We'll use big numbers, but even numbers. Let's say you had $1 million. You had 50% of your portfolio, that would be $500,000, in individual bonds. We use individual bonds because the risk and the return is predictable. I know if I own a bond that matures in 3 years and I put $10,000, I know I'm going to get $10,000 back. So I could care less of what's going on with the Fed. And if I get 4% interest on that bond, I know my rate of return is going to be 4% a year. So let's say in 2007, 2009, you had 50% of your portfolio in individual bonds. You had 40% of your portfolio in individual stocks or stock funds, and you had 10% of your portfolio in money market funds. So either individual bonds and stocks, or if you want to, we can substitute, you had 50% of your portfolio in bonds, 40% of your portfolio in stock funds. By March of 2009, your bond portfolio of $500,000 was up 10%. So the $500,000 was worth $550,000. Your stock fund portfolio was down 30%, so your $400,000 in stocks was down to $280,000. Your cash or money market fund was up 3%, so your $100,000 was worth $103,000. So at the end of the bear market, your $1 million portfolio was worth $933,000. In the worst bear market since 1974, you lost 6.7%. Now, here's the important thing. Had you stuck to your allocation strategy, you would have only been down less than 7%. And here's the thing that people get confused. During that time period, you would have still got your income from your bond funds. You would have still got your income from your stock funds. In fact, during the financial crisis, dividends actually went up, both in 2007, 2008, and 2009. So the bonds would have gone up, the stocks would have gone down, the cash would have gone up. Had you diversified, you would have rode out that cycle with a minimum of a downturn and experienced an increase in your income. And this is where I think a lot of people get confused when it comes to investments. They think that just because their stocks went down, that their income goes down. And that's one of the myths about market downturns. So it's something that there's been a lot of studies on. And I'll tell you, it's something that you want to have a diversified portfolio. You want to have money in cash because during that market downturn in 2009, when the S&P got down to 666, think if you had the money in cash to go out and buy high quality stocks at that time. And it's amazing. I just watched the other night, my wife recorded it for me. It was an HBO documentary on Warren Buffett. It was called Becoming Warren Buffett. And if you have a chance to watch it, I highly recommend you get it if you have HBO on your satellite or cable. It's very illustrative of a man who has made a fortune by taking advantage of human behavior. And there was this scene in the documentary, and Buffett is walking through the hallway in his office, and he's looking at these papers that he had framed on the wall of his office, and they were headlines from papers during these famous, infamous market drops, whether it was in 2009 or it was 1987 or 1929. And he was talking about, you know, this is how this guy has made a fortune. And it was recently announced this week that Buffett took and increased Berkshire Hathaway's position in Apple Computer. He used to own a little over 15 million shares, and as of the fourth quarter, according to his filings with the SEC, Berkshire owned 57.4 million shares. In other words, he increased his position in Apple during the fourth quarter of last year. What was happening to Apple stock? Apple stock was down 12% because there were worries about iPhone sales, worried about iPad sales going, iWatch sales going down. And basically, he was increasing his position because he was taking advantage of market sentiment. And now Buffett has made over $1 billion on that Apple buy. And John, let's go to that clip from the HBO trailer on Becoming Buffett, because there are several points that we can illustrate here that are very important to learn as an investor.
I thought I would pile her money, then she would unpile it, running a foundation, and therefore society would benefit. 99% of everything I make will go to others.
The largest gift ever given. It was completely amazing.
Investment problems, they're easy. It's the human problems that are the tough ones.
The point I wanted to get there, and in fact, that was the last part of the trailer. The investment part is easy. It's the human ones that are the hardest. And managing one's emotions are one of the most difficult things we have to do as an investor. We end up being our own worst enemy. We buy in at market tops and we sell at market bottoms. And that's one thing that Mr. Buffett learned from his mentor, Benjamin Graham at Columbia University. Graham used an analogy called Mr. Market, who was this emotional character that some days wanted to pay you the top price for your stocks. And on other days, he would sell you his stocks at bargain basement prices. And there's a new science that is developed called behavioral science that studies the human element of emotions and how it impacts investing. And this is something, John, that I think if there's anything you learn from this broadcast today or even watching the HBO documentary on Buffett, is learning to control your emotions. You can't be a conservative investor when things are going down and you're worried about losses and then flip and turn around and be a growth or a high-risk investor just because the market's going up.
It seems like we go through this pattern. This would seem to be the principal problem that the baby boomers faced. I mean, they have been through two bear markets that really devastated portfolios, and now they're jumping back in again. But the lesson to be learned is that they didn't learn the lesson from the previous events.
One of the riskiest things you can do if you are nearing retirement, 5 or 10 years out, just retired or in retirement, in the early years, it's called sequence risk. In other words, you do not want to go through a bear market at the beginning of your retirement. Imagine you're retiring in 2008, you put your money in stocks and you lose 45%. What are you going to do? Your $1 million is now worth close to $500,000. You just lost your income producing potential at the very beginning of your retirement. It's referred to as sequence risk. So if there's anything I want you to walk away from in listening to today's broadcast, you need to have a plan. You need to have an investment philosophy, and you really need to know yourself. What are your risk tolerances? If you're a conservative investor, which is what you should be if you're nearing retirement, just retired or been in retirement, you need to know that risk, and you need to stick to your plan in your asset allocation model, just as I illustrated with the diversification between cash, stocks, and bonds. You don't change that just because the market's hitting new records. The only time you want to reallocate is to protect yourself as we head into a recession in a bear market. In other words, your asset allocation should change with the economy. If we're getting towards an economic peak, if we're getting closer to a recession, if we're getting closer to, let's say, a bear market, then those asset allocation mix should change. You should have a shift a little bit more towards bonds and cash and less from cash. But outside of that, you keep your asset allocation mix intact, and you don't change it just because the stock market is going up and setting new records. If you have some money in stocks, sit back and enjoy the ride while the market is going up, but you don't change and say, all right, the stock market's going up. I'm getting rid of my bonds because they were bad performers last year. Now I'm going all in stocks. That is a very, very dangerous proposition.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, Reshma Kapadia, who is a senior editor at Barron's, is going to discuss the real cost of health care in retirement, what it ultimately comes down to. That's tomorrow right here on Lifetime Income. Now, time for our real life case study, which, as I always say, is based on real life. That's why we call it a real life case study. We do change the names of the people involved in order to protect their privacy. So let's fly with the example this week, Jim.
Up on deck this week is Manny and Cheryl Martinez. Both are age 58. Both hope to retire in 5 to 10 years. According to our health questionnaire, Manny's age probabilities are age 90. For Cheryl, age 93. Their risk tolerance is moderate. And investment objectives, they would like to have income with some capital preservation. A little background, Manny is an IT manager. He's been very active in managing his finances. He started in the 90s as a day trader, buying stocks in other investments. He's managed 6 different accounts spread across 3 different firms and has experienced some very sizable losses, both in the dot-com bubble in the early 2000s and, of course, the financial crisis in 2000s. He made a lot of money in gold and other alternatives, but gave back most of his gains from gold and even more so in some cases. Now, recently, he's focused on private equity and hedge funds because of his losses in stocks and gold. He still has maintained a large gold position by his own admission, according to him, because I can't bear to lock in losses. In other words, his gold is at a loss, and it is a much larger position of his portfolio than it should be, especially for somebody nearing retirement. Now, Manny's thinking about retiring in 5 years, but is not sure if they have the ability to do so. For that reason, he came to us looking for guidance, and more importantly, being able to control his own emotions. I mean, he's gone from losses in 2000 in tech stocks, losses in stocks in 2008, then losses in gold, and more recently, losses in his hedge fund account. So his wife, Cheryl, is a homemaker. She's been focusing on making sure they're prepared for retirement. She remains concerned about the cost of retirement because her family has a history of longevity and, unfortunately, Alzheimer's as well. Cheryl is much more conservative than her husband, and she's concerned about the riskiness of their investments, especially through the roller coaster ride they have gone through with their portfolios over the last decade. She's hopeful that Manny is able to retire soon so they can spend more time together. What are important to Manny and Cheryl? Retiring in 5 to 10 years, managing the risk of their investments, especially what happened in 2000, in 2007, and then with their gold investments since 2011, changing their investment philosophy and lowering taxes. Now, taking a look at their current budget, essentials were about $65,000, discretionary $26,000, total about $91,000. Manny's wages are $94,000. They have roughly about $3,000, which is some of the worries they think about when it comes to retirement, which they hope to do in 5 years. Their retirement budget, the essential budget, would be $56,000. Discretionary would be $28,000, a total of $84,000. Their Social Security would be $49,000 between them, and the shortfall would be about $35,000. Now, looking at their portfolio, their primary residence is $320,000. Their foreign real estate is $350,000, a vacation home. Manny's retirement assets are about $902,000. For Cheryl, $73,000. Their joint investments are about $1 million. Hedge funds, about $300,000, and precious metals, $430,000. Total investments, $2,725,000. Total assets, about $3.4 million. One of the things that we had to talk about in some of the challenges of the plan was adopting a more suitable investment style. I think chasing fads, I think the day trading trend, and now hedge funds, which were losing them money, improper diversification, concerns about liquidity. He had some liquidity issues dealing with some of the hedge funds that he was locked into that he could not get out, despite the fact that he was losing money. The tax efficiency of his investments. In the end, what we did is we proposed a complete change in investment philosophy, a balanced approach between not only individual bonds, blue chip stocks that paid dividends, and some cash, because we wanted a portfolio that would hold up well in an economic downturn. We reduced the size of his gold holdings, used some of those losses in gold to offset gains that he had in certain investments so we could get them more properly allocated with a plan that would not only fit their income needs, fit their diversification and risk needs, and not go through this, what I call risk on, risk off, and follow the latest fad in investing. That would produce roughly about $62,000. Total income would be almost $111,000, less a budget of $94,000, leaving almost $17,000 in a surplus. And basically what we were able to do, we highly recommended that he quit chasing returns by investing in yesterday's winner and no longer invest in what we call the flavor of the month. Instead, we implemented goals based on an approach to invest in a manner that would help him and his wife retire. We also recommended that they consider using a professional money manager, which in the end, they chose us, to reduce the impact of this emotion that we constantly get when we're focusing on fads, trends, and the evening news or the investment du jour. He was overexposed to certain sectors in this case, just as he did in precious metals and technology stocks. We recommended consolidating his accounts into one firm to make it easier and reduce the overlap of investments. We also recommended that he drastically reduce his exposure to hedge funds and gold down to a 5% allocation of his total assets. I mean, he could afford to take some risks there, but being over allocated is one of the problems that he would have much more money today had it not been chasing funds. And by shifting his investments away from growth into income producing investments like dividend paying stocks and bonds, his portfolio became managed in a more tax efficient manner. In addition, by reducing exposure to precious metals and hedge funds and other alternatives, we were able to lower their taxes by reducing short-term capital gains and other tax drags that created some of his tax issues as well as his investment loss issues. And so, John, once again, diversification, having a plan, sticking to that plan, and not chasing returns, as so many investors do, is really one of the most important things that I think we can take away. It'll be one of the things, if you watch the documentary on becoming Warren Buffett on HBO, I mean, if you take a look at how Buffett made his money, good example is recent purchase of Apple. Everybody was worried about Apple in the fourth quarter last year. iPhone sales were down. iPad sales were down. Stock was down 12%. Buffett comes in, increases, doubles, and triples his position, and he's just made $1 billion. So now we know why he's the second richest man in the world. Not everybody can be a Warren Buffett, but we can certainly learn from some of his principles. He doesn't chase returns. He waits for the perfect pitch, and then he buys.
You know, it is interesting. Every time you look at how some of the great investors of history performed, they had a philosophy and it was methodical. It wasn't a make money overnight type scheme. They had a long-term strategy. But notice that they don't chase returns here. That's the one thing they're not doing. They follow the philosophy, and at the moment when it's right, they make the investment and reap the reward from that. So I guess it's a lesson. Not everybody can be a Warren Buffett, but we can learn.
Absolutely. You know, I do hope, if you have the time, watch the documentary. I was absolutely fascinated. Of course, I was raised on Graham and Buffett growing up. Ben Graham was one of my heroes in graduate school and made me fall in love with the stock market. My last year in graduate school, he passed away. And I can remember reading an article in Forbes, Ben Graham's Last Will and Testament. And of course, we learned from, if you study Warren Buffett, it was one of Buffett's early mentors. I hope you have a chance to watch it. It is well worth it. You'll be fascinated. This gentleman who took $100 of his own investment and turned it into, what, $76 billion, I think, is net worth today. So fascinating. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week. We'll be right back.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.